Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's the first one of the year. It's for January 11th. It's brought to you by One World Sports. I'm John Gibson, and with me in cyberspace is Jim Allen. Happy New Year, dude.
Happy New Year. It's we're not in 2015 anymore, I gather.
Not in Kansas anymore, buddy.
Okay. I don't see Toto, so we're probably not in the 80s either.
All right. Well, it's our first show of the year, so sweet 16 to everybody out there. Thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it. On this first show of the year, we have a quick chat with Jonathan Fine. He's the Hiroshima Carp executive we spoke with last year. I'm happy to have him back on the show this year. And we're going to talk about Kenta Maeda joining the Los Angeles Dodgers and a whole lot more. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases!
Okay, well, almost a month, exactly a month ago today, I bumped into Jonathan Fine, or I would have if he hadn't shouted at me.
You there!
Exactly. Hey, Jim. And so I didn't bump into him, and so no health insurance cards were exchanged or anything like that. So anyway, we were at the baseball winter meetings in Nashville, Tennessee, and he stopped and said hi and said thanks for the podcast and many nice things. And as some listeners may remember, we spoke with him a year ago, and he told us how he got started with the Carp and his experiences in Hiroshima's front office back in the 1990s. So in any case, in December, like 3 days before I went to Nashville, the Carp announced that Kenta Maeda had been posted, and which was a little bit of a surprise to me because, A, the Carp are famous for being thrifty, and, B, they could still post him in 2017. So I had a few questions for Mr. Fine, and let's hear what he has to say.
Let's talk a little bit about the Kenta Maeda posting situation. Obviously, this is a thing that's been going on for a couple of years, and last year, Mr. Suzuki said to the extent that, well, when he pitches like an ace pitcher, and he came out and did that this year.
Yeah, and I think the proof has been in the pudding, right?
I mean,
here he is. He's been posted. I think he did what the club asked him to do.
Right.
And he earned the opportunity. Right. And I think the club saw that. I mean, it's going to be...
That's a bitter pill for the Carp to swallow, though, to lose your ace pitcher.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously, Mike Henn's irreplaceable.
Right.
But, you know, they have known about this. I do think they're preparing for it and have been preparing for it, and they'll be ready for it. I think they wish him well, and, you know, I think the fans want to see him succeed, and, you know, the Carp are going to have to do what they can to shore up the starting rotation, but they have a lot of candidates, both, you know, the foreigners that have pitched well for them,
right.
Chris Johnson's coming back, as well as some of these younger Japanese guys that are ready to step in and contribute.
Let me ask just an aside there. Now, I'm going to go back to the owner. The owner was probably saw, in your opinion, it was sort of a win-win situation for the Carp.
Yeah, I mean, look, this has been going on for a couple of years now, and Maeda-san has wanted to challenge himself in this way,
right.
and try and get to the big leagues. That's been known to the club. The club's wanted him to continue to perform as an ace. He's done that.
Right.
So the team has benefited. It's an opportunity for Maeda-san to benefit.
Yep.
And ultimately, you know, for the fans, you know, they get to see a homegrown guy succeed in the big leagues.
Another one.
Yeah, another one. Yeah, speaking of the other one, you know, we're hoping he's part of the solution next year, too.
Yeah, that's one never knows. I don't want to go a little bit, we want to diverge here so much because we're running out of time. But let me ask you about the process of finding replacements. Now, you've got, Chris, you've had fairly good success. The Carp have had very good success getting foreign players, getting high-value foreign players. I think of, you know, Brad Eldred, and I think of Brian Bullington. I think of Chris Johnson. I think of Colby Lewis. What's the story? Is there a secret, or is there a method? Is there a method the Carp are doing something that other teams that not teams without, you know, with the big payroll can do?
You know, I'm going to be honest with you, Jim. It starts with Eric Schulstrom and Scott McLean,
okay.
our scouts. Eric in particular has been doing this for us for 15 years now. He is very seasoned.
Don't say that. It seems like he was pitching here 5 years ago.
He's 2002. He started doing this for us.
Oh, that hurts.
And so, you know, look, Eric's a very smart guy. Eric's a very hardworking guy. Eric pitched in Japan for 4 years and has a very keen sense for what it takes to be successful over there. You put all of those ingredients together, and that's going to make for a tasty stew in terms of someone who has the ability to attract good players.
And then it's your job, basically, to discuss with the agents and sort of find a package that works for their guys.
That's right. I mean, the scouts have to find who the appropriate candidates are. And then, in terms of availability, signability, that's where I work on relationships here at the winter meetings so that we can have the easiest time possible to try and sign the guys once the talent is identified by our scouts.
So how long's your target list this year for guys you're looking for?
You know, honestly, there's no set target list.
But you have a number of people, though. You have a number of names of players that you're interested in.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, Chris Johnson is coming back. Brad Eldred is coming back.
Right.
It's been reported that we signed Jason Friday.
It's been reported. He said the Carp sent him a case of baseball.
Yeah, so it's been reported that we signed Jason Priday. We are definitely on the lookout for some additional help.
Right.
But sort of who we get and what positions they fill, it sort of still remains to be seen based on what they want to do with our Japanese players here headed into the winter.
Right.
For
example, what in terms of like pitching roles? Or,
sure. Okay. For example, like a closer. Right. You know, is Nakazaki going to close? Is he going to set up? If not, who goes into the other role? I mean, and again, I don't even know that he's going to be in either of those roles. I'm not part of that decision-making process. But just by way of example, you know, they might ask me to find someone to fill one of those two roles if they don't feel like they've got a Japanese player who's right away ready to step into that role. But again, it's a moving target, right? I just have to continue to stay in touch with people.
Okay, so you're cultivating.
Basically, okay. Yeah. Basically.
All right. So with the might of the urgency is there, though, to find a starting pitcher, you've got to be.
I would say so. Again, sure, we're at the back of the rotation. They're going to be looking to fill a few of those roles. But I would say to you, Jim, they're not in a rush to sign a foreign player because they have a lot of capable young Japanese starters who might be ready to step into one of those roles. And I think part of it is them wanting to see what they've already got under their belts before they rush out and bring in foreign help.
Okay. All right. I think that'll do it for me. Thank you much. Thank you again, Jonathan. It was a pleasure to talk to you. And thank you for being as forthright as you can be, being a team executive and a lawyer and all that.
Jonathan, at some point, I hope we can meet face-to-face. I really appreciate it. You sound like a really fun guy. He's got a lot of energy.
He does. He's very excited. He's got a lot of irons in the fire as well, which if you Google Jonathan Fine, you'll see that he's deeply involved in many, many things in North Carolina. He used to be an executive with the basketball team there.
Mm, yeah, well, he's got a lot of energy. Sounds like my kind of guy.
Okay. So tell me what you want to go on about there.
Well, obviously, this was last year.
It was last year. It was December.
And the issues you discussed, you were concerned that it wouldn't be relevant at this time. But I think they were all relevant and they'll be relevant into the future. And it's great to hear from someone from the Hiroshima Carp organization, especially at this time, have them articulate about Kenta Maeda and what the club was thinking during the process. And of course, this was at the very beginning of the process, so this was fascinating for me. Posting a player is a big deal, and you can see that obviously it takes a lot more than just the owner saying let's post him, because obviously the players, the organization as a whole, the player development officials or guys who are in charge of player development, they all have to have an input in saying, I think we can manage without this player if we decide to go this route. So you can tell that it was a big discussion, or is a lot of discussion behind the decision.
I think you might be reading too much into it. I think a lot of that is after they decided.
Possible, but I mean,
because I don't know. I have this impression of the carp as being the owner, sort of like decides things on the fly sometimes.
That may be
unfair, but I get the feeling sometimes that that's the decision number one. Although they do have a very good grasp for the business side. The carp are famous in Japan for always making a profit.
Right, right. But and of course, I don't really want to start the new year with a big butt.
What?
Per se.
Well, there's
so a lot of... I'll just use a however.
Okay. You can back into it then.
Right. Nice one. With the cap on the posting fee,
mm-hmm.
I don't really get this notion or this idea of the carrot and the stick in front of the players, but like, for example, demanding that they perform like they're irreplaceable before the teams actually replace them. Mm. Because before it used to be, well, look, if you do this and this and this and basically stock up your value,
mm-hmm.
then we'll post you because then it we can get some value back in return for you.
Right.
But now there's a cap on the posting fee, so it really doesn't matter. You know, whether the guy has a bad year or a good year,
mm-hmm.
pitches like an ace or hits like a home run king,
mm-hmm.
they're only going to make a finite amount of money.
Right.
So I don't get this thing where the ownership is saying, or management or whoever brought this notion to the forefront, you have to perform like you're an ace and then we'll consider letting you go, because those days are gone.
Well, yes and no. You know, Japanese baseball is kind of a weird animal sometimes, and they're still a little bit stuck in the past. This idea that, you know, it's a personal thing and it's not business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it smacks so much of that. It's not really about the business. It's about a personal thing. And I think they get lost in that sometimes. They get lost in that malarkey they try to sell the fans.
Yeah, well, they must be drowning in it a little bit. And so, yeah. You know, as I mentioned before, the impact on the team, the impact on MPV and on Japan is really profound each time one of these players goes to the major leagues. So it shouldn't be understated. But to hear Jonathan talk about how the team has a plan for this and how they're expecting, or they're looking at the bullpen and they're looking at the rotation and they're trying to figure out what foreign players to go after to, you know, in terms of gathering talent to make sure that they can withstand the impact of having a star pitcher like this leave the organization. And, you know, I look at guys like Daichi Osera. Obviously, it's going to be his third season. Aaron Kuri, Kazuki Yabuta, guys like that who might be able to step forward and give the team more than we had seen in the past couple of years in some cases. And in the case of Yabuta, he only pitched a little bit last year, but you think maybe he can settle into the rotation and maybe stay in there. But just like Jonathan said, they have some young Japanese pitchers who are capable, and I think they can withstand it. If you look at the numbers that Maeda put up, he only actually ended up winning 15 games. So if you're trying to replace 15 wins, I think that's doable. When Masahiro Tanaka left the Rakuten Eagles, it really left a hole in their entire pitching staff to try to replace all the things that he did in terms of wins. But I think they could almost make up the 15 wins just with the guys they have now. And if they add some talent on the mound, they're really going to be in the same position they were last year. They just don't have that ace kind of guy. But I mean, they had two aces. They had three aces last year they didn't win.
Wow. Sounds like they had one at the sleeve or something. The I think, you know, I guess to put a bridge between what you said and what I said, because I think we're not that far apart. Now, saying that the carp maybe made the decision after they made the plan, I don't think that's true, but I wouldn't be surprised if the front office and the front office and the people who actually do the work had a plan in place in case the owner decided. That wouldn't surprise me at all, because if you're a team where the owner makes the rules as he goes along. It's part of the, you know, part of the deal. You got to be ready for that. That's possible. I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, maybe it wasn't even at the plan stage or where you could call it a plan, but it sounded to me that Jonathan and someone else and some other people within the organization had at least had it on the discussion level and
brought
it to the table. And that's what it sounded like. Maybe
they had, of course, and when we spoke, they had no idea whether Hiroki Kuroda was going to be back or not. So,
right.
That's always an interesting one. Whatever, you know, Kuroda, you know, throws the I Ching and, you know, decides that things are going to come out a certain way. Now, one of the things that we spoke about last year and which I touched on a little bit. One of the things that struck me, or I had to mention, especially because they weren't here and they were sort of conspicuous by their absence, Eric Schulstrom and Scott McLean. And I talked to Jonathan about that. And I mentioned a year ago that the Carp have done very well in acquiring foreign players, which has always interested me. Now, about 5 years ago, I did a study that suggested the Carp were one of the most successful importers of foreign talent in NPB, along with the Yakult Swallows. Now, I've since updated my resources, extending Bill James' win shares system back to 1946. And I figured, you know, what the heck, I'll repeat the study. Now, over the last 10 years, of all the value generated by foreign players in Japan.
And that's pitchers and fielders
and batters, the whole bit, the whole shebang, their fielding, their offense, their pitching. The Swallows first signed 15.3% of that talent.
15.3, okay.
Okay, and as you know, there's 12 teams in Japan, which is about 8. The norm would be about 8 point something.
Okay.
Okay, so they're about double. The Carp were second with 11.3%.
Mm-hmm.
The Hanshin Tigers third with 10.5%. It's kind of interesting that the Central League teams were doing most of the importing. Now, these were players playing the last 10 seasons. So a lot of that is like Alex Ramirez, you know, guys who aren't playing now and so on and so forth.
Matt Merton, yeah, okay.
Okay. The Rakuten Eagles and Yomiuri Yuri Giants were both under 5%. Okay. Now, the Giants are interesting because while they imported less than 5% of the foreign value in the past 10 seasons, they had nearly 10% of that value on their roster.
Meaning
other teams signed them before they went to play for the Giants.
Okay.
So, and again, this is a big chunk of that is Alex Ramirez and Seth Greisinger and Dickie Gonzalez.
Right.
So on and so forth. So anyway, thinking now, the SoftBank Hawks are sort of outdoing the Giants.
Outdoing by...
In the sense that in 2015, the Hawks foreigners created more value than the foreigners on any other teams in NPB.
Okay.
But the biggest chunk of that is from Dennis Sarfate and Lee Deho, one of whom started with the Carp, Dennis Sarfate, and Lee Deho started with Oryx.
Right.
So anyway, I'm going to put that up on my website so people can see that. But okay. The whole point, the whole thing, and I was thinking about this, was one is the Carp still doing a great job of signing foreign players and getting them to, you know, and getting to perform well in Japan. But then, you know, you think they might want to try doing what the Swallows do, which is start locking them up on long-term contracts.
Yeah. Well, you know, as soon as he said Eric Schulstrom and Scott McLean, I'm like, oh, man, blast from the past, because those are two guys I got to write about.
Mm-hmm.
But we weren't doing the show when they were playing, so I didn't really get to talk to them that much. And, you know, with the Carp players, you know, they're here and, you know, zip, they're gone. I don't remember either of those guys actually playing a full season. I'm sure Scott.
Well, Scott McLean finished his he came back to NPB and played with the Carp briefly. He played most of his time with the Lions, and then he went back and he had a cup of coffee again with the San Francisco Giants.
Okay, yeah. But
Schulstrom pitched here for a while, but he was gone by 2002, which I'm thinking, man, get out of here. Like, get out of town. It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, oh, wait. 2002 is like just the other day.
It was?
I liked when he talked about that. But yeah, you know, the imports, whether the Carp come up with import pitchers or if the guys they have now develop. And this is the other thing I love talking about, is the development of players. I think I've had this argument or discussion with a lot of friends, and I say, look, you can't just put these players in a pot and expect them all to be, you know, done at the same time. Guys develop at different rates. They develop at different times, at different ages. You know, you can't even have the, you know, when you have a draft class, they're not all the same age practically. You have some high school guys, you might have a college guy in there, you might have a guy from corporate leagues in there. So you've got different ages. These guys still have to develop. It takes game action and game time to get used to game situations. So hopefully they'll have some people who can step up. And I think
we agree that they have the quality to step up, but you know, that's they have the raw talent to step up, but whether they have the, you know, the people put, you know, answer the questions they need to answer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, stepping up and pitching well isn't always going to equal wins. You know, it's just,
especially with a Carp.
Especially with the Carp.
But you have a team that scores runs by the basketful and doesn't give them up, but can't win.
Hashtag high heat.
Yeah, that's strange.
And you got a team that should play good defense and doesn't.
Strange year last year for the Carp. But fascinating stuff from Jonathan. We really appreciate it. I'm glad you were able to give us that little... I mean, it wasn't that long, but it was really informative for me.
And very energetic,
yeah. All right, let's make a two-seam transition and talk about Kenta Maeda. Maeda Ken signed with the Dodgers. Now, he gets an 8-year deal, and he can make as much as $106 million if he stays healthy and reaches these goals. And I wrote a blog post before he got signed. I wrote a couple, actually. I said,
someone, a couple?
Just a couple on him specifically. Oh, okay. One, I said somebody's going to overpay for Maeda or Maeda Ken pretty soon. And then we did talk about it on the show that he had this elbow issue, and then that came up in his physical, the medicals that they were doing on him. So that is one of the reasons why he didn't get as much money as we thought he would, thought he would. And then, so I wouldn't call it an overpay when you talk about 8 years. And they're actually kind of expecting, it seemed like the Dodgers just put it in their minds, well, at some point he's going to have Tommy John. We're just hoping we can squeeze whatever we can squeeze on the front end out of him. And then hopefully that we're contending and we can make it a run to the World Series or something. That's what it sounded like. But
maybe
both sides have accepted that, so that's no big deal. But he's got to make if he reaches all these goals, he can make a lot of money. Now, that's not a great situation for him, because now the teams in control, sometimes they might take him out of some games that he might actually be able to continue pitching in. But I don't see that happening.
I
don't think that. But I think, you know.
Yeah, the Dodgers being afraid to spend money is, you know, I don't see that.
Not in recent years, no.
No, they're almost like, oh, yeah? Well, let's put him in there anyway, because he's got a bonus coming. We'll show we're ready to spend.
Yeah, that's right.
We're in Beverly Hills, baby.
Right. But the signing was no surprise to me. I think a couple of days before they actually did sign him, in a blog post I wrote, the Dodgers cannot afford to let him get away, was the theme of that next post that I wrote. And I said, look, the Angels have a lot of money. They need pitching. I thought they would be in the running, and the Seattle Mariners I thought would be out there because they are a West Coast team, and perhaps they would, you know, throw their hats in the ring and see what was going on. But I just felt like the Dodgers had to go out and get him. He already made it clear that he wanted to be on the West Coast, and I don't think San Diego I think San Francisco was pretty much tapped out in terms of how much money it had spent.
Yeah, they weren't. San Francisco and Arizona basically got what they wanted. The Padres weren't interested from the word go. It was like, this is going to be the price. Well, we'll go look for the Japan market somewhere else.
Right.
I mean, that's what they told me in Nashville. It was like, well, I'm sure he's a great pitcher.
Yeah.
So he'll go to some other division. We got our fingers crossed. How much does that cost?
Well, yeah, all right. So they went the cheap route, but that's fine. But the Dodgers got him. Now, I don't know. I remember when Kuroda signed with the Dodgers, and there really wasn't all that much fanfare when he joined them, and that was back in 2007. And you know, they said, well, yeah, it looks like he'll be a number three or whatever. And then in the playoffs, he ends up throwing a really great game for them and saving their or extending their series. I think it was with the Phillies or the Cardinals, one or the other. It probably was the Phillies. I don't remember. Bad memories. Everybody knows that I'm a Dodger fan, so I can't remember the playoffs, losses, only the wins.
Playoffs, yeah. Playoffs and Dodgers. It's like, yeah, bad karma for the last 30 years or something.
But I think it was the Phillies. But, yeah, I like him pitching. I think he actually, obviously, Maya Kent doesn't pitch like Kuroda, but I think he could put up similar numbers in terms of wins and stuff for them. I think he's gonna actually have a better defense behind him than he has had with the Carp. If you look at the third base and think about the Dobayashi situation and the Brad Eldred situation in left field, not that Brad was awful, it's just that he wasn't the fastest guy, and whatever advantage you can get on a defensive player, the better that's going to help you. So I think that'll be favorable for him. I think they're going to have a pretty good defense. It's a pitcher's park. Other than Coors Field in Denver, I think San Diego's pretty much a pitcher's park. I think San Francisco, if you stay away from right field, and the big gaps out there. Well, yeah, they have those gaps where you can get extra base hits. I mean,
I know what stay away from right field is. Right field will kill you.
Right field and right center, I think, is those are the big gaps out there. So.
Oh, okay. I see what you're talking about. Okay.
Right. I think if he keeps the ball out of those areas, he'll be all right. But I think he's probably going to be fine.
I think so too.
I don't know. I'm biased. I want him to do really well. I just don't think he's a great dominant pitcher. So I can't sit here and say I expect him to win 15 games or something.
Well, you know, he's the pitchers who have pitched very well in Japan have pitched very well over there.
Mm-hmm.
I think the pitchers in Japan, the Japanese pitchers who've done the best in NPB, have done very well in the States. Tanaka, And the people who have, if you look at the guys who have gone, the pitchers who pitched better in NPB than Kenta Maeda, there's only three. Hideo Nomo.
Oh, in NPB.
Yes. Hideo Nomo, Masahiro Tanaka, and Darvish. Period. Kenta Maeda is the fourth best pitcher to go to these states.
Oh, okay. And now, how do you come up with that number? Or that?
That's from their peak value in win shares.
Oh, win shares. Okay.
And their total value. Either way you look at it, it's the same thing.
Well, because Irabu was
wasn't as good.
And I never thought Kei Igawa should have been going over to the States. I didn't think he was that good.
Matsuzaka is nearly as good. Kuroda was nearly as good. But they were one of the things that Maeda has been is extremely consistent. The only young good pitcher who went to the States,
mm-hmm.
was anywhere near as who was more consistent was Darvish.
Okay.
I mean, the other guys, even Kuroda, had good year, bad year. It wasn't until he went to the States that he was good every year. Same thing with Matsuzaka, same thing with Nomo. Well, Nomo was kind of burned out before he got there. He would have been much better if he hadn't had his third and fourth year in NPB.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard an MLB expert talking about Mike Cannon and the fact that he didn't have like a wipeout pitch, and obviously, yeah, his slider is really good, and people talk about his slider, and
he's going to have trouble with the slider, I think, making that adjustment.
I don't know if he's going to have trouble. I was just thinking that the ball is bigger and it's different.
It's slicker. It's harder to. It doesn't. Well, because the skin of the ball,
mm-hmm.
the surface of the ball is smoother, which means it doesn't break as much.
Okay.
So that's a big issue, and his curveball and his slider are going to be affected, and he's going to have to learn to deal with it. On the other hand, he's going to find his two-seam fastballs a lot better.
Yeah.
His two-seam fastball, his change-up, his four-seam fastball are all going to be better than they are in Japan.
Well, I mean, his pitching aside, I was thinking more about the batters and their approach over there. I think because he's got good control and the NPB players are so adept at putting the bat on the ball and making contact, and big leaguers are looking to drive the ball and they swing differently.
Oh, another adjustment.
I think if he is able to locate, and just like Darvish went over there and say, hey, look, I'm not a power pitcher. I'm not a guy who blows people away. I have a lot of good pitches and a lot of other stuff. And remember, the first thing they do when you go over there is they say, you're throwing all these pitches. No. Let's go faster. Fastball, slider, change up. And yeah, let's take all these pitches. I mean, so they make the guy. They say, hey, you know, you're a great guy. You're a great pitcher. This, that, and that. Let's change you.
And if you're, you know, and I think if you look at the guys who went over, there's a couple of characteristics to the guys who are really good. One is, A, they're really smart, or they're really physically talented, somebody like Darvish.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things is they all tend to be sort of gregarious, the guys who do well. The people who struggled the most are the guys who have, well, I won't say Urabe wasn't gregarious, but he had other issues. And Kei Igawa was the opposite. He was a wallflower.
Yeah.
And Maeda Kenta is, I mean, Kuroda's not, I guess he's not gregarious, but he's friendly and he's open-minded and he's smart as can be. The guys who've done well have had a lot of those extra things. And I think Maeda is really a smart guy. Yeah. He's going to surprise people with how good he is. He can learn to be, I should say.
Okay. Did you hear, you know, that little swimming motion exercise that he does?
He's going to do it. He said he can't do it.
He's not able to do it in front of the dugout. So he said he's going to do it in the dugout.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty funny. So in conclusion, I mean, you know, I'm a Dodger fan, so I want to see him do well.
Yeah.
And,
I'm almost like I want him to see him do well most of the time.
And I'm glad we'll get him most of the time. I know what that means. But I'm glad we get some more Dodger games on NHK. We'll be getting, you know, at least a couple a week.
I knew there was a cost to that.
And I can tape them instead of trying to wake up and watch them on MLB at bat or something. Wait till the game's over and then start watching. So, yeah, it should be
fun. Are you blacked out in Tokyo, too?
Thank goodness we are not. Thank goodness we are.
You get to see more Dodger games than people in LA.
That's true. Thank goodness Time Warner hasn't come over here yet.
Hashtag hi.
Wow.
All right, let's make a two-seam transition and talk about Kuroda just for a second. Now, he got a big payday the other day. And this was before we taped our previous show, but we didn't get a chance to talk about it. And I did see your tweet about him, and you talked about the fact that his salary was or equals a third highest salary in NPB history behind Kazuhiro Sasaki, who was with the Yokohama Bay Stars, and he had 650 million yen, and then Hideki Matsui, who had 610 million yen. So Kuroda's getting 600 million yen for this next season. Now, I wrote a blog post right away and I said, well, that's cool. But if you look at the numbers and the raw numbers, I think Chris Johnson outpitched Kuroda last year and he deserves a lot of money.
Well, he's on a 2-year contract, so that's what you get.
So, yeah, I just thought, well, okay, he's going to get this much money. He's going to go to the front of the rotation, and that's probably good for the Carp. I'm not so sure it's going to be good for him, and I hope he stays healthy, but I don't know. You know how these guys get locked in for the first, I don't know, 5 to 10 games or so. They get locked in and they're always facing aces on the opposing teams. And if he's going to be pitching against aces, then I'm sure he's going to be fine in terms of his pitching, but to win games, his win-loss record might take a little bit of a...
Well, that's irrelevant. If he's got to pitch against the best, then, you know, he's the best one. That he's a good person to do it. So
yeah, I agree.
I think a couple of comments I'd make about that is, one is, as I learned recently, take the salary figures with more than a grain of salt, except then when they come from the Giants, because the Giants like to advertise that their players are the highest paid. And I can tell you with honesty that if Kuroda's contract is actually for 600 million yen, then he is not the highest pitcher, highest paid pitcher ever in Japan. He's just the one who has the highest reported salary ever.
Reported salary. Okay. Well, you know what I thought when I saw the figure? I thought, okay, this is definitely his last season, and this is like his little golden parachute.
Oh, I think it is partly that, but I think the team, first of all, his coming back to the Carp was worth much more than the $400 million they paid him last year.
It's true.
They got a huge, they had the record attendance for the Carp. The merchandise sales went through the roof. They couldn't print Kuroda shirts fast enough. So I think he was underpaid at $400 million last year, and they're probably saying, "Well, we could have afforded to pay you $600 million last year, so we'll do it this year."
Right. Well, I mean, his return to Japan was like a shot in a juiced baseball. I mean, you know, it was.
hold on. Let's move on from that analogy. I'd rather just move on rather than trying to analyze it.
I mean, you know, it was good for Japan. It was good for Japan as a whole. So,
okay.
And I'm glad. And obviously, I think this is going to be his last season, and I think that's part of it. So whether it's reported or actual.
Yeah, I think if it's reported and it's not actual, it means that he's getting paid more, which is possible.
All right. Well, if he gets paid more, good for him. Let's make a seamless transition and talk about the SoftBank Hawks, Nobuhiro Matsuda, who decided, no surprise to me because I was ripping him the whole time, decided to come back and sign and stay with the Hawks for this season and beyond probably. I had low expectations for him in the major leagues. I talked about the fact that he was pawning himself off as anything other than a third baseman in an attempt to get, I'm sorry, not anything other than a third baseman, but that he could play. You're looking around, that he could play.
I'm trying to figure out, I'm waiting to see what you're going to say because I haven't figured it out yet.
That he was pawning himself off as someone who could play other positions other than third base.
That's not accurate.
So, okay. His representation talked about the fact that he would play other positions.
That is almost accurate. His agent told me that teams wanted him to play other positions in case he did not have the offense to make it as an everyday third baseman.
Well, then that could just be agent talk too. I mean, I don't know. I didn't see him as a corner infielder or outfielder. And I said that on the show before, but I just have to imagine that all the offers that he was getting just didn't float his ship, you know?
Okay. He had offers. He had offers that were not quite what he was looking for his minimum to be at third base.
Uh-huh.
Now here's the thing. The other thing about his is it's very weird. Everything about Matsuda's negotiations were very weird. He has essentially two agents who were not working together.
Huh?
He has an agent in the major leagues, which was Legacy Agency. He has an agent in Japan who was a Sawako Nakamura. And Sawako Nakamura is his agent, basically dealing with the Hawks exclusively. And here's the other thing. And she was also, according to Japanese media and people I spoke with in the United States, talking directly to the Padres, which was not in her, you know, portfolio.
That's not in your contract.
Exactly. She had no deal with the Padres, but she, from people have told me that she's basically not really well versed in being an agent, and that she is the agent because she is a colleague in the same law firm where Matsuda's wife practices law.
So this is a prime example of how two heads are not better than one.
Absolutely. So it could very well be a case of, you know, his agent is his wife's friend. And there, it was all sorts of, I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but it's just complicated. And it was very complicated, and I think that made that made a huge difference. I certainly think he could have played in the major leagues at some level. I think he could have played in various positions if he wanted to. I think he could have played well enough to play third base, but we will never know because he didn't try because he had all this other stuff going on in the background. And I think it wasn't the Hawks 500 million yen a year. It was all this other stuff going on in the background. He just sort of said, like, okay, just leave it alone. I'll stay in Fukuoka.
That's
my take on this because I was that's my take on it after looking into it for a bit.
Yeah, thank you for that because I just assumed he wasn't hearing the figures he wanted to hear, and if he was going to do that and go over there and struggle, he might as well stay here in Japan and enjoy the game and enjoy the team and the teammates and then winning. They're winning. Well, they can have a chance to win the third.
But here's the thing: if you want to play in the majors, and you're only going to get paid $1.5 million a year.
Yeah, feed your children.
Yeah, I know. It's like, if you're going to have to go over there and be in a soup kitchen, then why go?
# high heat.
Give me a break.
Yeah, you want to feed your family.
If you want to go to the major leagues and you turn down $1.5 million a year because it's not money that's going to suit you, get out of my face. I just don't want to hear anything about this or that. It's a matter of, what you're saying is I really don't want to go, or there's another. And I think in his case, he did want to go, but I think there were other stories. And I don't want to make a big deal about it because I think it was more it involved personalities. I don't think it involved skullduggery or any kind of conspiracy, which was my first thought. But I think it was more just a matter of maybe his family wasn't all that keen to go, or there was some miscommunications and things. I think that was probably more of it than anything else. I don't think there was a conspiracy.
Well, it sounds like it was convoluted, and I'm glad that he's going to be happy to be back here.
My hope is that he is happy. I'm not certain. I know he loves Fukuoka, but I think his wife's going to be happy.
Yeah. Well, I know that Kimiyasu Kudo will be happy to be able to fill his name in at third base every day.
I think so.
That would make me happy if I were the manager.
Just bring your earplugs for the Hawks practices now.
There you go.
You don't have to retire them.
All right, one note. Oh Sang-hwan, the South Korean reliever who pitched for Hanshin the past two years, we had mentioned on the show previous that the police in South Korea had been investigating his involvement in a gambling situation.
He gambled in Macau in a casino. He gambled legally in Macau, but it's illegal for South Koreans to gamble anywhere.
Right, right. So we learned that he won't be charged in Korea, so that's good for him. But it doesn't look like any Japanese teams are interested in getting involved with him. I don't think he'll be thrown into the Pete Rose boat or anything like that, but I don't think he's going to get a job in Korea. I don't see him getting one here, so he has been exploring options in the United States, and we just wish him luck.
He has received a 6-month suspension in Korea if mm-hmm. he should go back, so he was going to miss about 70 games if he does go back.
So he can return.
He can return. Well, that's good. He can do a MacArthur.
That's good for him. All right, let's go to fielding questions. All right, the first one of the year came from, because he sent it, he was the first one to submit a question, came from Stuart Miller at Stuart_Miller18, and he says, who are the names on this year's Japan Baseball Hall of Fame ballot who should be elected? And that's really tricky wording. Should be.
Well, should be as in they ought to be, they deserve to be in, or should be, they're likely to get in.
He's saying, who do we think should be in?
Okay. I think the people who will be elected are, there's three possibilities from the players. Masaki Saito, the former Giants ace, he's the guy on the ballot who had the most votes. He's the guy who had the most votes last year who's still on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
because one guy got elected and the other guy dropped off, Tatsunori Hara. And so I think he came very close last year. Now, he's going to lose some support because Kimiyasu Kudo is a first time. I think he's going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Right.
And the other guy who has a good shot is a Kazuyoshi Tatsunami.
Hmm.
Now, those are the three guys, I think, who have a good chance to be elected.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Now, as for the guys who I think should be, I'm working on a story for jballallen.com, and there's a guy in the experts category, which is by people who pass a test to be experts and living members of the Hall of Fame. And maybe he does. Maybe a lot of the living members of the Hall of Fame don't like him. But Kihachi Enomoto, first baseman for the Mainichi Orioles, the Mainichi Daimai Orioles, and the Tokyo Orioles from 1955 to 1971, was one of the best players of the 60s, who somehow managed to always play second fiddle to somebody. He was never the league's best player. He was often his team's best player, but he played with a Hall of Famer. He played against a lot of Hall of Famers. It was a very tough competition to be the best player in the Pacific League when Katsuya Nomura was in there and so on and so forth. But he was one of the league's best players. He was one of Japan's best players in the 60s. But anyway, he's very similar to another guy who's on the players' ballot. Their careers are almost, if you gave Enomoto more home runs, these two guys would look like twins. And that guy is Kazuhiro Kiyohara, who, other than Enomoto, has the most valuable overall career in terms of win shares of any players who are not in the Hall of Fame. So the two most valuable guys out there are a pair of first basemen. The only difference between them is Enomoto is a left-handed hitting first baseman, Kiyohara was a right-handed hitting first baseman with more power, who played in an era with more home runs. So it's but their careers are almost dead even. And the voters don't seem to really although Enomoto got some support last year in the experts division, Kiyohara is just sort of stuck. Nobody really wants to vote for him. He's such a divisive character I can see him not getting elected.
Interesting. Well, I mean, I had something to say about that because I know we just had the elections in the major leagues and people were talking about a unanimous or first ballot guy. And I always say, hey, you know what? When a player comes onto a team or he's coming up, he's rising on a team, he's getting some playing time and he's starting to establish himself as a player, he still has to earn every step of the way, every at bat, and there's a line. You know, he's got to wait his turn. He's got to wait in line. He's got to earn the opportunity. And I think it's the same with the Hall of Fame, that just because you have a great player who's now eligible, you still have guys who have been working their way up the ladder. Now, the ladder isn't the same for everybody, and the steps aren't the same. The distance between the steps aren't the same, so to speak. So maybe some guys deserve selection, but there are some other guys who are all probably deserving, not maybe just as deserving, but deserving on their own right, and have been waiting in line to get in, and it's just their time.
Well,
so I mean, you got to wait sometimes, and so
you do.
I look at the Hall of Fame.
I don't think Kudo is the most deserving person, but I think he's going to win in the first ballot. He's the most deserving pitcher.
Yeah, I don't think you know. Again, he was a guy who pitched for so long, he was able to compile because he was really good early on, and he was really effective still late. At the very end of his career where he stopped being effective, but he was really effective. But he was never great. But I think, too, that, yes, I think he deserves to go in, and he probably will go in. And the question was should, and I think, yeah, he's one of the guys who probably should. And I still think Tuffy Rhodes should go in. And I'm in
agreement with you. I think Tuffy Rhodes is very deserving to be in the Hall. There's no foreigner who's even close to him.
I'm going to toot that horn until somebody says, hey, okay, stop making all the racket.
Put a mute on it.
Gosh, and you're not even that good.
Agreed.
So those are the guys. I'm looking at those two guys. I don't think they're gonna. I don't know what's the record or how many. What's the most people who have been selected for the Hall of Fame in one particular voting?
Oh, I don't know. I would guess maybe four or five, but usually it's four because of the limitations and how many you can vote for. And the ballots, actually, there aren't that many people on the ballot, but they don't. They don't seem to reach agreement. There's like kinds of players who just aren't going to be voted in. They voted in so many guys who have no business being there.
Mm.
And they've essentially, I did a quick survey. There's about 70 players in the Hall of Fame who are there because they were of their playing careers. Okay.
Uh-huh.
About half of them are pitchers. Because as we know, you know, when there's nine guys on the field, there's four pitchers at the same time.
Hashtag high heat.
But basically, there's a bunch of pitchers because pitchers, you know, there was an era in Japan where pitchers, where it was fairly, I won't say it was easy to be a starting pitcher, but where it was easy to get outs. It was easy. There were a lot of easy outs in the lineups. And these guys were allowed to throw their arms out against lineups that had four and five easy outs in them. And they were able to throw 350 innings a year for a prolonged period of time and run up incredible. And again, there was also great diversity in terms of the quality of the teams. You know, you're playing in the Central League.
Uh-huh.
You had teams like in the 50s, like the Dragons, who just didn't win at all other than 1954 when they, you know, they did win. But yeah. And you had a lot of teams that were failing and couldn't afford to, you know, they were selling their players and moving their players around and, you know, paying, you know, signing guys who were lousy because they had no money. And it was like teams playing against the Western and East. There were like Western and Eastern League teams in the Central League. Mm. So, and the same in the Pacific League. There were some just horrid teams. And because of that and so many, you know, easy outs even on the better teams, these pitchers ran up incredible. I'm not saying they weren't worthy because they were overworked in that context, but they could throw 350 innings, you know, and win 35 wins a season wasn't that unusual in the 50s. All those guys are in the Hall of Fame. And all the guys who are just as good, you know, who struggle to win 18, 19 games in the 80s and 90s.
Because they were facing better talent.
Yeah, better competition, right. Tougher competition. They're not going to get in.
All right, so there you have it. Our next question is from the Graveyard Ball Guys, and it's an MP3.
From moving the team to Tokorozawa in 1979 to a scandal that was in the mid-2000s, what kind of legacy did Yoshiaki Tsutsumi leave behind when owning the Seibu Lions for 26 years?
Yeah, Yoshiaki Tsutsumi, our favorite convict.
Yeah, I just know about the scandal in the mid-2000s because I was here.
Yeah, 2004, yeah, I was the year all that, you know, the baseball strike and Sunio Watanabe left as owner of the Giants to the cheers of people who worked at Yomiuri. It was quite funny.
Yeah, yeah. I came back at the end of 2004 and then spent 2005, and that was about it. So
Tsutsumi went to jail, and I guess his biggest legacy is kind of interesting, but I'll just keep it. First of all, I guess he has three. One is he robbed Fukuoka of their baseball team. And he kept Fukuoka without a baseball team for 10 years to the detriment of Japan. Then he put a roof on Seibu Dome. We all know how well that worked out.
Well, they can play games when it's raining.
They can play games when it's raining. They can play games when it's miserably cold and miserably hot. Of course, to be honest, I went to a lot of games at Seibu Stadium. And if you went there on an afternoon day game with all that AstroTurf, you needed Lawrence of Arabia out there to withstand the heat.
Yeah.
Okay. It was dry, miserable California, Las Vegas, sandy heat.
Cooking.
Okay.
You could
cook your bento there on the grass. Okay. And I guess the third legacy was trying to keep the Nippon Ham Fighters from going to Sapporo because he wanted to use Sapporo to build up his attendance because people didn't want to go to Cebu Dome. So he argued that, well, you know, I'm an expert on keeping teams without their, you know, keeping cities without baseball. I did it in Fukuoka. We should do it in Sapporo too.
Hashtag high heat.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't know much about the guy. I just, like I said, got back to Japan in 2004, late 2004 and 2005. Watched all the strike stuff that was going on from the States, but was not involved and never met him. And
I've never met him.
You say he's out of jail or he might still be
in jail? I think he's still in jail.
Yeah. So there you go, Graveyard Guys. Yeah, I guess you said it was hard to dig up the information in English. And I looked at his page on Wikipedia and it's just as hard in Japanese.
Sure, yeah.
All right, so Glenn in Tokyo, we will get to your question next time because we want to go through. He's got a three-part question, and I want to address each item individually and give it some time. So we will get to that next time, but we appreciate the questions from everybody. Thank you very much for staying or listening to the end. Now, we will continue our Twitter feed. You can send us a message there, hashtag it high heat, at JBW Podcast. You can send mail the old-fashioned way via YAKYUJOHN@gmail.com.
When did email become the old-fashioned
it
way?
It is. And you know what? We don't use it anymore. People email me, and I'm like, what are you doing?
You're so 2000.
Yeah, you're so 2000, man. You've got to.
You're so turn of the century,
go
man.
Go on Facebook and send me a message like everybody else. What is your problem?
Get out of the Stone Age with this electronic mail, man.
Right. So, yeah. But we do still have the Facebook page. It's been pretty dormant. I try to be more active on the Facebook page, and you can leave us comments there. Look for us on iTunes, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Enjoy your off season.
Ciao.
One World Sports is the exclusive home of the Yomiuri Giants in North America and features live coverage of all Giants home games. Please contact your local cable provider to find out how you can watch One World Sports.